President Volodymyr Zelensky makes some changes.
He said in his address that Ukraine needs a new structure. As of now, a few ministers have resigned and the parliament has accepted their resignations.
Plus, Israel continues its push in the West Bank.
We discovered that in Jenin, in Ramallah, there is a serious military industry that actually produced for many years.
And later, what a right-wing victory in Germany might mean for Kyiv, and a look behind China's actions in the South China Sea.
Today is Wednesday, September 4th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Lori London, along with Steve Karish. Russian strikes killed at least 7 people in the Ukrainian city of Lviv overnight Tuesday, with dozens more injured. This a day after one of the deadliest missile strikes since the war began. The latest assaults come as President Volodymyr Zelensky looks to reset and reorganize his war cabinet. On Wednesday, one of the most prominent faces in his government, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, resigned, and more changes are expected. For a deeper dive on those changes to the government in Kyiv, I spoke with VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gengadze. What do these changes say, first off, overall, about Zelensky's strategy?
President Zelensky today emphasized that the personal changes in the government are necessary to strengthen Ukraine. He thanks the cabinet and the ministers personally for their work and commitment. However, he said in his address that Ukraine needs a new structure. As of now, a few ministers have resigned and the parliament has accepted their resignation. Some of those who resigned, like the vice prime minister of European integration, Olga Stepanishina, and minister of strategic industries, Alexander Kamyshin, will be appointed to different roles, and in some cases with increased responsibilities. According to my sources, this is not the case with Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, who became some kind of prominent face of Ukraine for international partners. He was seen as too bright for the taste of the presidential administration, people say, and has recently been sidelined. When President Zelensky was asked specifically about Kuleba today, he said he would not comment on the future of any particular minister. Some sources say that Andriy Sybiha, a diplomat who is currently a deputy head of the Office of the Presidential Administration, will be the new foreign minister of Ukraine.
Kuleba seemed to really have a genuinely good relationship with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other international diplomats. It would seem that that role and the relationships that he built would be a tough act to follow necessarily. Is this person that's taking his place, will he be able to sort of take it from there?
Andriy Sybiha is seen as a very professional diplomat. He took initiative in the presidential administration or peace talks as Ukraine was introducing, and with the new security agreements that Ukraine signed with different countries. So it's he's professional, we can say. Would he outshine or not outshine Kuleba? That would be difficult. However, I think the international partners would accept anyone who will be in the foreign minister of Ukraine. And Sybiha is seen as a person who is devoted and in line with the head of presidential administration, Andriy Yermak, Ukrainian presidential administration. And Yermak personally would like to be seen as a main foreign policy guy in Ukraine at this point.
Do we have any idea what the military strategy will look like? Will it be very different?
In terms of military strategy, nobody expects much changes. However, we have to understand that the mood in Ukraine is very somber. The last 2 days, shocking number of civilians died, and in the regions like Western town Lviv, they didn't experience the level of attacks like this before. So there would be it's a somber and kind of more kind of dark time for Ukraine today. And I have to one thing that I have to emphasize here as well. It's important to mention that according to the latest opinion poll conducted by Razumkov Center and Democratic Initiative Foundation in Ukraine, the majority of Ukrainians believe that the office of the president is exceeding its power in influencing other branches of government. A sociological survey indicates that the presidential administration exceed excessive influence on the law enforcement, anti-corruption, and judiciary bodies. Specifically, 58% of Ukrainians believe that the office of the president influenced decisions made by Verkhovna Rada, the parliament, Ukrainian parliament, and 59% see the office's influence on the decision of the cabinet. So compared to last year, more and more Ukrainians share this this opinion. And that's kind of add to this sober and I would not say negative, but kind of worrying situation in Ukraine.
So does that seem to also indicate that Ukrainians in general are not 100% confident in these decisions that Zelensky's making as far as the changes in his or shuffling of the government?
You know, because of the war, Ukraine has not held election, and the President Zelensky believes that reshuffling of the government is necessary. The question remains whether this reshuffle means a tighter grip on the country by the president, or it's a genuine attempt to make some quality changes. I had a chance to talk today with the editor-in-chief of one of the most influential publications in Ukraine, Ukrainska Pravda, Sevil Musaeva, and she did not have definite answer. She believes this reshuffle looks more like musical chair.
And here's a part of Miroslava's interview on the reshuffling with Ukrainian journalist Sevgil Musayeva, editor-in-chief of Ukrainska Pravda, one of the most independent and influential publications in the country.
Why it's happening now? Is there something happened that pushed this reshuffling, or it was prepared and planned for a long time?
Actually, a lot of sources of Ukrainska Pravda and people from the government were waiting for some shifts in the government for the last few months. And actually, there was some discussion that probably even the head of government will be changed, I mean, prime minister. And actually, there were some candidates on this position among current ministers and current governments in Ukraine. I think that, first of all, this is an eternal situation in Ukraine. People want some change. People want to find a new way how Ukraine will fight during next year. There are a lot of problems inside the country, I mean, with energy sector, with finance sector. And I think these changes are very important, first of all, for Ukrainians and for country and for people of Ukraine, because they were waiting for some improvements on Ukrainian politics, first of all. Of course, we don't have an election during wartime, so this is the only way how we can improve the governance of Ukraine.
VOA's Miroslava Gongadze in Warsaw with Ukrainian journalist Sevgil Musayeva.
A reshuffling of the government isn't the only thing on the minds of Ukrainians. News of a far right-wing victory in Germany also has Kyiv worried about the future. VOA's Henry Ridgewell has more.
The far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD party, scored an emphatic victory in the Thuringia state election in the east of the country and came second in neighboring Saxony.
The majority of people in Thuringia do not want business as usual. They want political change, and political change will not be possible against the strongest force in Thuringia. And I am curious to see how the old parties will then try to somehow form a losing coalition. That will be exciting.
It's the first state victory for Germany's far right since World War II. The newly formed far left BSW party came third. Although widely predicted, the results have shocked many of Germany's allies, not least Ukraine. Germany is Ukraine's second biggest donor of military aid, second only to the United States. That is now in doubt.
Both the far right and the far left populist forces were campaigning on cutting German aid for Ukraine, and they were explicitly calling for a reduction in military aid. They called on the government to finally pressure Ukrainians to start negotiating with Russia.
In the short term, analysts say the state election results won't affect the federal government's funding of aid to Ukraine.
But you already see a slight change in the rhetoric of the centrist parties. We have four centrist parties, and some of them already took some of the narratives or the frames that the populist and far-right parties were using.
German Minister of Finance Christian Lindner of the Liberal FDP, part of the ruling coalition, is pushing for aid to Ukraine to be halved in the next budget. His party gained less than 5% in the Thuringia state election and fears a repeat in federal elections next year.
So it's really a sort of a fight, a battle for political survival, especially for the liberals who are pushing for this agenda of cutting the budget for Ukraine.
Immigration was a major issue driving votes for the far right, with much rhetoric directed at non-European and especially Muslim migrants. But Germany is also hosting more than 1 million Ukrainian refugees.
The question whether they and how they should be funded and whether they should be drafted or sent to Ukraine, that is a delicate issue. And we have males, Ukrainian males that are legally eligible for the draft. So there is growing pressure also on the male Ukrainian refugee population in Germany to push them back to Ukraine.
The Social Democrat Party of Chancellor Olaf Scholz noted that German intelligence services had classified the AfD as an extremist party and said its victory in Thuringia must act as, quote, a wake-up call. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish with Lori London. China's increasing hostility in the South China Sea and recently in Japanese territorial waters as well. We'll take a look in a few minutes.
Now, more on the situation in the Middle East. Late Tuesday, the United States announced criminal charges against Hamas's top leaders, including Yahya Sinwar, over their roles in planning, supporting, and perpetrating the deadly October 7th attack in southern Israel, which killed 1,200 people, including more than 40 Americans. Merrick Garland is the U.S. Attorney General.
As outlined in our complaint, those defendants, armed with weapons, political support, and funding from the government of Iran and support from Hezbollah, have led Hamas's efforts to destroy the state of Israel and murder civilians in support of that aim.
The complaint names six defendants, three of whom are deceased. The living defendants are Sinwar, who is believed to be hiding in Gaza, Khalid Mashal, who's based in Doha and heads the group's diaspora office, and Ali Baraka, a senior Hamas official based in Lebanon.
Meanwhile, Israel continues its almost week-long assault on the northern West Bank to root out what it says is Hamas and Islamic Jihad infrastructure. Palestinians say at least 20 have been killed, and the Israeli operation has ripped up roads in Jenin, and Israeli analysts say tensions are rising. Linda Gradstein has the story from Jerusalem.
Palestinians say it is the largest IDF military operation they have seen in the West Bank in more than two decades. The assault is focused on the northern West Bank, including the cities of Jenin and Tulkarem. Israeli officials say the operation targets West Bank terrorist leaders, and their forces have killed at least 29 of them. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have said most were members of their organizations. Israeli analysts say Hamas has started focusing on the West Bank after being weakened in Gaza. Kobi Michael is a senior researcher at Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies.
In the Gaza Strip, where Hamas is almost totally dismantled, and Iran and the Hamas leadership abroad understand pretty well that they lost a very crucial and essential asset which is part of the resistance axis, or so-called resistance axis led by Iran, and they are trying to compensate for this loss by intensifying the terror infrastructure in the West Bank.
Israeli political and military officials say terrorist activity in the West Bank has increased, including the local production of weapons. Amit Halevi is a member of the Likud party and the Israeli parliament's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee.
We discovered that in Jenin, in Ramallah, there is a serious military industry that actually produced for many years those, it's not only missiles like you mentioned, it's also bombs, it's also various of weapons. And I think this is our targets.
But Palestinians say the operation in the West Bank is also hurting civilians, especially in the Jenin refugee camp. They say the army has dug up many roads searching for explosive devices, which has made the camp impassable. Water and electricity have been cut off in some areas. Palestinian analysts say public opinion in the West Bank is growing angrier. Mohammed Darama is a Palestinian journalist at Ashark, a pan-Arab news service.
Recently, a new phenomenon emerged in West Bank, people who are willing to fight, and they are collecting weapons, guns, driven by the kind of revenge feeling in towards what's going on in Gaza and the daily practices of the Israeli occupation.
The number of Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers or Jewish settlers in the West Bank has been rising, with the United Nations reporting 680 dead since the war against Hamas began last October. Israel says 22 soldiers and Israeli civilians have also been killed in the West Bank during the same period. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
China has been acting more provocatively lately in the South China Sea, with more frequent confrontations with Philippine Coast Guard vessels and a recent voyage through Japan's territorial waters. While it seems that these moves are an effort to project strength and perhaps expand their own territorial waters, one question remains. Why now? To find out, Steve spoke with Taiwan-based correspondent William Yang.
So I think the broad consensus in the region is that China basically sees a window of opportunity in the coming weeks and months due to the upcoming leaders' election both in Japan and the United States, that both of these countries, which are two of the largest democratic countries that are sort of holding together the regional alliance that is containing China's expansion, maritime expansion in the region. So they are doubling down on multiple fronts at the same time, expanding their territorial disputes in South China Sea with the Philippines to a different reef that is called the Sabina Shoal. And I think we also need to add in Taiwan in this mixture because, as we know, all these three countries are part of the first island chain that really prevented China from projecting its naval power to the Western Pacific. And the Chinese has also been, in fact, increasing the number of sorties around Taiwan on a daily basis since August 26th. So I think this is overall the Chinese testing Washington's ability to keep up the coordination with allies in the region at a time when they know that the U.S. will probably be very distracted from this part of the world all the way until at least January 20th next year when a new government comes in.
So why are they doing this? What's their goal? Is it to have control over more of the sea?
I think it's basically to increase, wrestle back the control of territories that they view as their own. And because they see what has happened over the last 2-3 years, that the Biden administration has really been able to bring together democratic countries in the region to coordinate and increase their joint patrols and at the same time strengthening security and defense-related cooperations. So they feel threatened, obviously, by this U.S.-led effort to strengthen the counter pushback against what China has been doing essentially since the early 2010s, which is that they are trying to claim as much of the South China Sea as their territory as they can. And this particular upcoming period is a period that they clearly know that the pushback and the coordination between the democratic countries will be much weaker compared to over the last almost 4 years when Biden took office.
It seems like by antagonizing the Western countries, they're inviting more hostility. They're inviting more of a reaction from the Western countries. Wouldn't it be in their best interest to lay low at a time like this?
Right. I think they believe that the South China Sea and the competition with the United States across the Indo-Pacific has essentially entered into a near zero-sum situation, which means that if they don't bolster their own stance and position and project their power when they see a window of opportunity like this, then they essentially will only face a stronger containment that is led by the United States. And so the Chinese is strongly in this belief that they need to bolster their own stance before rather than compromising their own position. Because if they compromise their own position, they're only going to see their room for maneuverability across the Indo-Pacific shrinking further if the Democrats won the election in November. At the same time, domestically, whenever they are struggling to, say, boost the economy, it's been struggling since the beginning of 2023, or to really increase or bring back the Chinese people's confidence in the government, they try to project their strength outward and use that in a way to spin through the domestic media outlets, which are all controlled by the government, this more positive tone and positive image so that it can neutralize that domestic discontent towards the struggling economy and the bleak outlook overall inside China.
VOA reporter William Yang. William, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you so much.
In a related story, the top U.S. envoy to Taiwan assured the self-governing island that it has American support and said Washington will continue to follow through on its commitments to ensure Taiwan can defend itself against threats from China. Raymond Green is the director of the American Institute in Taiwan. He said that Taiwan and the United States have a shared and abiding interest in maintaining peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. The United States remains committed to supporting Taiwan's ability to defend itself and will continue to maintain the capacity to resist any resorting to force or other forms of coercion against Taiwan in line with the Taiwan Relations Act. China claims Taiwan as its own territory, to be taken by force if necessary. Calls and emails to the Chinese embassy in Washington were not returned.
Uganda's police force spokesperson, Roseke Kutuma, addressed the media on Wednesday after main opposition leader Bobi Wine, who has emerged as the most formidable opponent of veteran President Yoweri Museveni, was shot in the leg by security agents in a northern suburb of the capital, Kampala, on Tuesday. Kutuma told journalists that officers had attempted to block Wine and his team from marching down a road, resulting in an altercation where Wine sustained injuries.
That despite the warning, he insisted on proceeding and blocking the road, leading to police intervention to stop the procession. During the ensuing altercation, it appears he sustained injuries.
And he added an investigation will be conducted to clarify the facts.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Lori London and everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.